Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Hello everyone and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast, and today we bring you an episode that revels in the extraordinary mix of adventure, horror, myth and fact that makes maritime history the best type of history. We're finding out about the history of castaways, of people set adrift on open boats, marooned by accident or even on purpose. This is the history of being abandoned, of being adrift, of being alone. Many never came back and are lost to history, a tiny dot vanishing on the horizon of the past, never to be seen again, while others did come back, and they told their story. This means that historians have been able to study castaways and their experiences, and what a history it is. To find out more, I spoke with maritime historian Graham Filer, who has spoken with us before on the history of the Mary Celeste, and what a fine episode that was, so please check it out. It's one of our most popular. Luckily for him, Graham was safe at home when we recorded this podcast, and so, comfy, warm, fed, healthy, clothed and sane, here's Graham. Graham, thank you very much indeed for joining me this morning.
Thanks very much, Sam, for your invitation.
Right, castaways. The more you think about castaways, the more complicated they are and the more different types of castaways you can identify. Why don't you tell me a bit more generally about a castaway?
Well, castaways come in different colours, shapes, haircuts and lifestyles and whatever, genders. What we usually think of as castaways are castaways from ships or other vessels that have had a drastic catastrophe at sea, or some major collision with a coastline, an island, a shipwreck, in other words. Once that vessel has been, basically is no longer a platform of security, then the people from it are crossing a line, or have to cross this line of great security into one of no security at all.
Mm. Let's just talk about that. So, I mean, the ship itself, it's got food, it's got other people, it's got safety from the elements and governance. There's a system on board, isn't there, to kind of maintain security and safety?
Yes, it has a population, it has all of those things. And I, having thought about it quite a bit, think that in light of the castaways' predicament, is that the governance of their small community is paramount, because they need to have someone at the head of the pack, the leader, who sustains the hope of rescue, survival, and so on.
Yeah.
Notwithstanding the fact that most of them are cast away in small boats or rafts with no provisions or very scant provisions at all, and very, you know, more dangerously, no fresh water.
Mm. I think it's interesting that you can have castaways who have found themselves on a raft, as you mentioned, or an open boat. There are plenty of examples of those. And then you've got castaways who find themselves on a remote stretch of mainland. Others find themselves on islands. It's the different way that you can experience being a castaway that I think is fascinating.
Yes, and they, for the most part, the least perilous form of castawayship, if you like, is being on a desert island or a deserted island, because there are always resources there that will sustain you. Vegetation. In some parts of the world, like the small islands in the Southern Ocean, for example, south of New Zealand and Australia, the Auckland Islands and the Antipodes Islands, where a number of shipwrecks happened that were famous for how long the survivors spent and were able to resource sustenance to keep them going for, in some cases, over a year. And in one case, in the Auckland Islands, there was a shipwrecked party of survivors there at one end of the island, and were so rugged and inhospitable that they weren't aware at all of the presence of survivors from another shipwreck there at the other end of the island. But they all, they were there for 18 months or so, and they survived. The others, less so. But they all managed, what they had and what the leader of them had to get out of them was the resourcefulness to sustain themselves with whatever means of subsistence they had. In those areas of the world, it was often walruses, seals, mammals, and seabirds, including seabirds' eggs in particular, but very little in the way of plant life except for rough tussock grasses and things like that. But in other parts of the world, on islands where... I'll give you an example of one of those, was at the end of the chain of the Hawaiian Islands were some islands near what was called as French Frigate Shoals, Midway Island and Ocean Island, which is at the very far end of the Hawaiian Islands chain. There are several shipwrecks there of motor ships, actually, you know, not sailing ships. And they stayed on the island, and there were 60 or 70 people from one of the shipwrecks. And they were perfectly well sustained by the albatross eggs and albatrosses themselves, but not from the provisions left over from the ship. So they were, and the weather was relatively benign, rainfall and that sort of thing. Whereas in other parts of the world, you don't get much rainfall. You certainly don't get very benign weather, especially in the Southern Ocean, around the Crozet Islands, I'm thinking of, for example. But most interestingly and most dramatically were the islands of south of New Zealand and Australia, as I said. Some very famous and infamous shipwrecks there.
The whole story of castaways is also linked with trade, isn't it? I think this is interesting. So you have people who maybe have a shipwreck, and the whole point is that they end up drifting to a part of the ocean which is not regularly passed by shipping. So even in the kind of the, you know, the mid-19th century, you're getting people who are cast away, even though there is quite intense global trade going on. So there are still parts of the world which are not regularly visited.
Not only that, but they were parts of the world where the oceans are so extensive that you could have a lot of shipping going by, but they are on shipping routes. So they, if a ship or even a string of ships goes within 20 miles of where you happen to be, you know, lying on some atoll in the middle of the Pacific, nobody would see you, nobody would know you were there. Remember, this is all happening before there was any substantive means of communication, because we get castaways these days. I mean, castaways of from yachts that have sunk and whatever. But we also have IPRB emergency beacons and all sorts of other means of communication. In those days, you have to remember, there's absolutely no means of communication whatsoever, apart from a distress signal, which might happen to be seen by someone, but by a, you know, a very small chance. So when they were wrecked on islands in the Pacific, although there was a lot of trading and trading vessels going around the Pacific, and by the way, it was mainly around the Pacific that you, and the Indian Ocean, Southern Indian Ocean, that you get these big sort of events of castaways getting shipwrecked or adrift, for example. It wasn't in the Atlantic, it was mostly of collisions leaving ships sunk and the survivors in small boats. And one of those, actually, that I wanted to tell you about, which was very interesting from a number of points of view, did happen in the Atlantic, which was the sinking of the yacht Mignonette in 1884. And this was interesting for one very big reason and another sort of coincidental reasons. Now, the yacht Mignonette, which was a small 19-ton, it's about 35, 40-foot boat, was being taken to Australia, or ordered to be taken to Australia by its owner, under a crew of four people. The captain, Dudley, first mate, Stevens, an AB, just a seaman, Brooks, and a 19-year-old cabin boy by the name of Richard Parker. And they left Southampton to go to Sydney in May 1884, stopped at Madeira on the way, and by early July of 1884, they were in the mid-Atlantic, roughly halfway between Africa and South America. Taken over by a severe storm, the ship was knocked about, it sunk, the four of them got into a small boat, and they were adrift with 2 1-pound tins of turnips in their boat. And that was it. No water, no thing.
Oh, no.
Anyway, so they're adrift, and they're right in the middle. There's no, they weren't in the in the shipping lanes at all. Anyway, they had their two pounds of turnips. After the fourth day adrift, they caught a small turtle, which sustained them for a few days. But then, after about 3 weeks or so, by the way, the boat was 13 feet long.
That's not much, is it?
And they were ailing. Anyway, after about almost three weeks, it was decided between Captain Dudley and First Mate Stevens, but not Brooks. Brooks had no part of it, that they would have to kill the cabin boy, Parker, who was about, sources say 17, 18, but I think he was 19 years old. Anyway, they were pretty, in the last stages. So they, between the two of them, decided Parker's got to go to sustain us. So unless a ship appeared within 24 hours, no ship did appear. Dudley approached Parker, who was lying in the bows of the boat, and said, "Parker, your time has come," or words to that effect. Took out his penknife, and Parker didn't have much to say except for, "Who, me, sir?" Anyway, he took out his penknife, stuck him in the jugular, drank their blood, opened up the body, ate the heart and the liver and bits of the body over the next 4 days before a ship came on the scene, the bark Moctezuma, a German bark, it was headed to from the west coast of South America, I think, to Falmouth. They found the three of them now, because the Parker was no more, or he had become subsumed into the two, because I don't think Brooks had any part of it. But anyway, they took them on board. They took them back to They took them to Falmouth, where they arrived early September of that year, 6th of September. In the meantime, Dudley and Stevens, but mostly Dudley, had written an account of the incident. He had no compunctions of doing so because he had no expectation that it was wrong or illegal or anything to kill someone in order for them to survive. So he had no thoughts that that would be used against him in any sort of trial or arrest or whatever. Anyway, he was arrested, so was Stevens, and tried for the murder of the boy Parker, and he was found guilty. There was a huge amount of sympathy for the two of them because of their situation. It was a life and death or life or death situation. But the benchmark case of English law decided that necessity for survival is not a justification for murder. Even in those extreme circumstances on the high seas, without the boundaries of the territory in which they were being tried and convicted, i.e. England. So they were convicted, they handed down the mandatory death penalty, but that was commuted by Queen Victoria to 6 months in prison. A lot had to do with the fact that there was so much public sympathy for them. Yeah. Anyway, they were out within 6 months and got on with their life, and that was it. But it was a very interesting legal case because it was a very interesting moral predicament for them. And to tell you the truth, it was nowhere near unique that people, castaways, ate the bodies of other shipmates or comrades or companions in small boats or in other similar circumstances. What was somewhat unusual was that they actually killed a person in order for that to happen.
I wonder if it was unusual that they killed the youngest person.
I think he was certainly the most susceptible.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have put up a fight. He was a young guy, and he was pretty, they were all in a very emaciated and weakened condition. That was almost certainly the case. He wouldn't have objected. Also, because Dudley was the captain, Stevens was the first mate. It was a sense of the pecking order there. Well, who's going to get the biggest peck when it came down to it, you know? And Parker was the boy.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? I thought what you mentioned there about public sympathy is interesting. So there's a lot of this in the press, isn't it? It's covered in the press, the inquiry, which I believe is at Falmouth as well. And it made me sort of think about, as you said, it wasn't a strange occurrence, and being cast away was not an unusual occurrence as well. And it made me wonder whether, as a society, we had more understanding, more sympathy of, you know, the difficulties of being at sea. We were kind of more attuned to the likelihood of this happening.
Well, I can tell you one thing. We certainly had more sympathy, more attunement with the sea itself and with the mariner's lifestyle, as it were. We don't today because we don't have that connection. But in those days, in those years, there was a great connection because that was the modus operandi of international trade, not least because the British actually had a merchant navy. The fact is that there had been, I wouldn't say numerous, but certainly quite a few other cases where people had been, castaways had been cannibalized at sea after they had died, and their companions, who were barely at the edge of existence, had basically eaten bits of their flesh to stay alive. And the only reason we know about this is because they did stay alive. And we can only guess at the number of incidents where, you know, they didn't. And but they were basically, it was not an unknown thing. But I think also that this public sympathy came from the fact that the experience of castaways and shipwrecked mariners was something that occurred at regular intervals anyway. You know, it was reported in the press. We just don't have that sort of thing, because life at sea today is far, far more safe and secure than it ever was in the 19th and century and before that. But a lot of these things were never found out about until...
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Until and unless they survived, for one thing. But it would have been months afterwards.
The Mignonette example is fascinating, and it's from 1880, but it makes me think that even by then, people had been familiar with stories of people being adrift in open boats for a very long time. And I'm thinking particularly here of the Mutiny on the Bounty, so the 1780s and Bligh. And that's an extraordinary story as well, isn't it, with people being adrift in open boats.
It's an extraordinary but also multifaceted story. It takes in so many dimensions because Fletcher Christian, who was first mate on the Bounty, organized a mutiny against what he and his mutineers perceived as being cruel and unusual punishment by Captain Bligh in the Royal Navy, when probably it was not particularly cruel and unusual. It may have been hard, and it definitely was hard, but whether it was cruel and unfair is a different matter altogether. But in that case, Fletcher Christian just put Bligh and 18 or so other Bounty men, crew members, into a small boat, 19 foot long, and that was really extraordinary small boat voyage in itself. They were forcibly cast away, chucked a few bags of hardtack bread, and then said, find your own way to wherever you're going to go. And he did it under sail in a small boat in 40 days. And if you look from where he was cast away off the island of Tofua in the middle of the Pacific near the Tonga islands, all the way to Timor, and if you think that's Indonesia now, going up, landing on northeast Australian coast, through the Torres Straits, and to Timor, where there was a Dutch settlement that he understood would be, the best destination for them. But the other, and he reached it in 40 days, which, to my mind, and he only had about 2 or 3 inches of freeboard on that, the boat to go all that distance. And it wasn't all plain sailing either. But he lost not a single person on that voyage. The other interesting aspect was that the Bounty mutineers themselves under Fletcher Christian went back to Tahiti. They had a cohort of Tahitian men and women, and Fletcher Christian's idea, where we've got, and with some of the other Englishmen, we've got to find a place to go and hide out, because basically they're going to come and get us because it was mutiny in the Royal Navy. So they said, look, we've got to find this, the most remote spot we can find to as a hideaway. And eventually they decided on Pitcairn Island, which was 1,200 miles or so southeast of Tahiti, where they were. They arrived there, set up a settlement. They burnt the Bounty at the bottom of the cliffs there in Bounty Bay. And that basically, they cast themselves away on Pitcairn Island to be safe. Now, what was interesting, and what I just, I'd like to go into this a bit as a, perhaps as a final thing, is that the Pitcairn Islanders, at the time, there were about 70 or 80 of them that set up a settlement there. By the mid-19th century, i.e., 1850s or so, the population of Pitcairn had grown to almost 200. So with the population now too large to be supported wholly on this small Pitcairn Island, they all requested and were displaced to Norfolk Island between New Zealand and New Caledonia in 1856, 193 of them. Well, in 1858, 2 years later, a ship by the name of the Wild Wave sailed from San Francisco. It was wrecked on Oeno Island, which is one of the Pitcairn group of islands, and they sailed, they left Oeno in a small boat and said, look, we've got to find some better place. Oeno is completely deserted. It has no fresh water, not even trees. It wouldn't support life. It's a wildlife refuge these days. But so they arrived in on the island of Pitcairn in March 1858, in that period when Pitcairn was completely deserted. There was a small settlement there. There were chickens running around. There were pigs running around. There were still corn and plants being, you know, growing. But in that two-year period when Pitcairn was deserted, these shipwrecked castaways from the Wild Wave arrived just when it was completely deserted. So, but anyway, they had the use of a lot of materials there, and if Pitcairn is a very fertile place. I've been there, and it's a fantastically fertile place for all sorts of vegetables and sugarcane and coconuts and whatever. But it's a very inhospitable for anyone coming across it and landing on it, because it's bounded by cliffs on all sides. It doesn't have a nice sandy beach or anything like that.
Have they embraced their history of being a location for castaways, or is it a kind of a forgotten history?
Pitcairn at that time was simply a group of far-flung people of community who ships stopped there mainly to pick up provisions of fresh fruit and vegetables, and they often called it the isle, especially whaling ships, because it was in their track. But a ship sailing from West Coast North America, San Francisco, Seattle, that track often took them very near Pitcairn as they sailed southwest and then southeast to go around the Horn. So they were visited quite often, but so they were known about. But it was nothing particularly special in the way we think of them today. You know, they didn't have press relations boosting their tourism appeal. In fact, these days they're on full throttle for that, because the population is only about 50, 55. But they do get a lot of cruise ships these days. But in that time, when the Wild Wave castaways, there's absolutely no one there. So they stayed for 4 months as they, Captain Knowles of the ship, were built and rigged a small boat for them to go on to the Marquesas Islands, which were some way towards the northwest, northeast. and well known as a refuge of, a port of civilization, in other words, Nuku-Hiva, that sort of area. And then about 6 months after they left, in July of 1858, in January 1859, the first small group of Pitcairners came back from Norfolk Island to repopulate Pitcairn. I think they just wanted to go back home, basically. And a small group of family members came back to Pitcairn. God knows what they felt when they saw that their houses had been slept in and their wood used to make some ship or whatever. I think Knowles left a letter or some sort of document to say that they had been there, but I should think that the Pitcairners were pretty surprised to have found someone castaway there in their absence. Yeah. But I think it was remarkable that in the 230-year existence of settlement of Pitcairn, that these castaways arrived right in the period of 2 years when there's nobody there.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? It made me wonder how you kind of research stories like this. Are there decent accounts of this in the press, or are you looking at private diaries and journals?
What I do is I basically go online. I used to go to the Guildhall Library, look at Lloyd's lists under the casualties section, and you'd often get a clue as to what happened, and I'd make a note, or they had a report. These days you can go online, research old newspapers from the 19th century in particular, put in a search word like castaways, or as I often do, terrible tales of the sea. And then you find something, and it's an opening. And then you prize it open a little bit more. And then you prize it, and you go into something. And there's one thing. I'll return to the mignonette just for a moment to show you what I mean. I didn't know this when I was looking at the mignonette as a castaway story. But it was a coincidence that the boy's name was Richard Parker. In Edgar Allan Poe's novella, The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket, in 1838, which was almost 40 years before the mignonette, there were four castaways in the story. There were four castaways in a small boat who drew lots to decide which one should be sacrificed to save the others. It fell to the man who suggested the idea in the first place, who is a sailor by the name of Richard Parker, which was the name of the boy who was killed on the mignonette. And the other coincidence was in Jan Matel's 2001 book, The Life of Pi, where the boy is in the lifeboat with the Bengal tiger. The name of the Bengal tiger was Richard Parker.
Yeah. I'm not sure coincidence is the right word. I think the people who wrote both of those books knew very well about the story of the mignonette.
You think?
Yeah, absolutely. We should just also talk very briefly about the whale ship Essex, because that's one of my favourite stories of people being cast adrift. We've had the story of the Mutiny and the Bounty, where you've got one human making another human a castaway. But this is a very different story, isn't it? Tell us about the whale ship Essex.
The Essex came out of Nantucket, and I didn't look it up recently, but I have read so much about it, but, dates and things. I think it was in the 1820s, and I think at the back of my mind, 1823, when whaling was at its height, or getting towards its height. So the whale ship Essex out of Nantucket by Captain Pollard arrived on the what was called the line, or the equator of the Pacific, and it was essentially rammed by a whale. It sunk. The men got out in three boats, but they continued to go southeast. They wanted to reach the coast of South America. Now, that was a long way from where they were rammed and the ship sunk, the Essex sunk by a whale. But they did get there. Two of the boats arrived, and they were rescued just off the coast of Chile, I think it was, or Peru, or northern Chile, southern Peru. But the interesting thing, the most interesting thing and most notable thing about the Essex, the sinking of the whale ship Essex, is that it was the inspiration for Melville's Moby Dick. It wasn't, which was published in 1851, so it was quite a long way away. But it wasn't the only ship sunk by a whale, and those weren't the only castaways cast away by a sunken whale ship, but they were the most famous. And from memory, I think there were three boats, and only two were rescued. The other was lost at sea, never heard of again. But there were a lot of interesting things about that, and I think cannibalism played a part in it. But also Captain Pollard, he went back to Nantucket, and in his old age, he was basically a broken and broken old man there. They didn't give him any monuments or anything. But it was one of the great non-fiction books of the sea concerned that sinking of the whale ship Essex, which is in the heart of the sea, which is a great read, actually, just for the drama. And it was a very, very dramatic incident because it was retold by the survivors, Pollard, but mainly by Nichols, I think, was one of the crew members. And a lot of these, you ask, where do I get these from? A lot of them, the stories are from narratives told by survivors of shipwrecks or strandings or collisions and whatever. So they get reported as verbatim narratives of the incidents themselves. And that I find most interesting because they're so immediate. You're right there. When you're reading these things, you're there in the presence of the aftermath of whatever incident is being narrated by a survivor of the incident, of the catastrophe, as it were. Yeah. I come from a place that was actually began life as a settlement of castaways. The Sea Venture was taking a shipload of colonists to Jamestown in Virginia, 1609, wrecked in a September hurricane off the northeast coast of Bermuda. It was wrecked. Everybody got ashore alive. Bermuda had never been populated beforehand, and that was the beginning of the settlement of Bermuda as a British colony from 1609, of which I am a descendant.
Fantastic. What a wonderful claim to fame. I think we should find out a little more about that another day. Graham, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today.
Sam, thanks very much.
Thank you all so much for listening. Now is the time for me to ask you for help. Please leave us a review or rating on iTunes. If you're listening on an iPhone, it's really easy to do. We've had 119 five-star ratings, and everyone helps us rise up the rankings and get listened to by more people, which helps us do our job to help people appreciate and understand the importance of maritime history. Please also check out our fantastic YouTube channel. Some mind-blowing material there. Recently, a fantastic little animation showing how composite ships were made, based on the most beautiful hand-drawn sketches you've ever seen, made by Harry Cornish, who was chief ship surveyor and artist extraordinaire at the Lloyd's Register Foundation in the mid-19th century. Please remember, this podcast comes from both the Lloyd's Register Foundation and the Society for Nautical Research. You can find the History and Education Centre of the Lloyd's Register Foundation at hec.lrfoundation.org.uk. And please make sure you check out their brilliant project, Maritime Innovation in Miniature, filming the world's best ship models with the latest camera equipment. It is completely extraordinary. I can tell you the team has just come back from Sweden, where we filmed four models, and also the Science Museum. And It really, really is worth seeing. So just Google Maritime Innovation in Miniature. It'll take you straight to the videos. This podcast also comes from the Society for Nautical Research. Please go there, snr.org.uk, and please join up. It's a fantastic way not only of finding out all about the maritime past from the very best in the business, but also of meeting people. And I very hope to meet you one day at one of their meetings.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.